Oh yeah. Welcome to the motherfucking Soulcast. Today's guest is a group of participants from the Olympia Fracking Blockade. To those who don't know, the Olympia Fracking Blockade was blocking the port of Olympia along the tracks for about 2 weeks, and by doing so, they prevented fracking proppants from being delivered and transported to fracking sites. So at the time of this interview, they had been raided and the camp had been shut down. So we're going to talk about, you know, overall what it was like, what they accomplished, the importance of occupations, and all the openings that it can create. We're going to talk about how they use FOIA strategically to gain counterintelligence, which could inform their actions. And they're going to talk about the long line of other events, from like anti-war stuff to the mosquito fleet shutting down Shell Oil in the Pacific Northwest, and all the other cultural things that led to the success of this action, and a little bit about the strategic thinking that went into the decision not to resist at the very end, and just a general like overview, kind of after the fact, looking back, talking about it, talking about what they've learned and what the experience was like. This is an awesome interview. It's actually really funny, so I had a blast doing it. These people sound really cool. And as someone who's participated in occupations, I can say that it you know, these autonomous zones, these cracks in history are really where some of the most magical stuff happens, especially when you're materially disrupting the infrastructure of capitalism versus railing against abstractions and just protesting things and asking for politicians to do things, which has proven just not to fucking work. Keep your eyes on Olympia. I doubt this is the last time shit's gonna hit the fan over there. If you dig this podcast, subscribe to it in iTunes, like it, and go to soulone.org/support. SOLEONE.org/support, and sign up to become a monthly sustainer. Now, before we start this interview, let's hear from one of the other members in the Channel Zero Anarchist Podcast Network.
Radical Underground is a podcast that connects underground music with radical politics from around the world. So if you like anarchy and good music about kicking fascists in the face, check us out on Channel Zero, SoundCloud, iTunes, and anywhere else you can find us. Sick of your right-wing bullshit, it's a fucking disgrace. So let the vegan betraying, kicking you in the face.
Okay, well, let's just say we're speaking with a random group of blockaders who participated in the Olympia anti-fracking material blockade. How's that?
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, that sounds great.
Cool. Well, so on Friday, y'all were raided at your camp. I guess we'll talk more about that later. So let's just start at the beginning. You know, what was the blockade? What were you blockading, and why did you do it? I know it's like a really generic question, but for the people who are listening to this who didn't know, what weren't tracking it at the time, if you could just give us a brief overview of what this project, what it started out as.
Well, so I guess essentially, so this, we'll talk, I want to kind of talk about this blockade specifically, but then I think it's also important to give a little bit of like history and context to like what, like how we got here in Olympia. And so, you know, this blockade specifically went up against the port of Olympia. So Olympia is at the very bottom of the Puget Sound. And so, and we have a port here that actually kind of really struggles to get like ship, to get like, have like cargo going in and out of it, because it's a long ways away from everything. It's a small port. And so they, a couple of years ago, they took a contract with this company called a Rainbow Chromatics.
Rainbow Ceramics.
And they're a Chinese company that is essentially like a middleman between like people who produce these like things called proppants and the companies who actually do the fracking. And so proppants are the thing that the Port of Olympia is importing and then exporting inland. And what and essentially it's one part of this like fracking slurry that they pump into the ground. And so there's these little chromatic beads that, I mean, they're called proppants because essentially they prop up the ground so that everything doesn't collapse, you know, where like as before, where like, you know, the shale and everything else was like holding up the land. Once you break all that up, you need something to sit there and like prop it up. And so that's essentially what the proppants are. And, I think, essentially people saw that this was like, you know, a point of leverage that people could use to essentially try and challenge, you know, the right of this process of fracking to exist and to challenge like, you know, the Olympia community's complicity in like, you know, this whole process of not only, you know, just oil and gas stuff, but also you know, fracking specifically, considering it's like extra horrendous, you know, I mean, people lighting their water on fire and like all, and then of course, like the man camps that get created and like, you know, all of like the indigenous women that are disappeared in the man camps is such like a focus point on so many different things. So, and then I guess a little, you know, a little bit of the history. Does anyone want to talk about like the port militarization stuff? Mm-hmm.
All right, and so there has been a long fight in Olympia against our port. We had back in mid-2000s, the Port of Olympia was moving military shipments, specifically Stryker vehicles, which are like pretty much mini tanks, out of Iraq and back to Fort Lewis. And so there was a movement called Port Militarization Resistance that some folks that were part of our blockade this time around were a part of port militarization resistance back in 2007, where we stopped the Stryker vehicles from moving out of the port for 2 weeks. So we occupied the streets. It wasn't a blockade. It was more of a rolling blockade of sorts, or rolling tactic of using our bodies and hard blocks and such. So we stopped that for 2 weeks. And what happened in the summer of 2016, the port was actually in conversations with the Army base Fort Lewis in moving more shipments through. So people were mobilizing around anti-military movement. And we actually, through as much through our uprising and through channels, we prevented the Army from moving their cargo through the Port of Olympia. And so we'd already been kind of meeting about that, and PMR was making a resurgence. And then essentially we won, and the general was like, no, we're not going to move through Olympia. We don't want to repeat of what happened last time. And we also at that very same moment had a ship of fracking sands come into the Port of Olympia in 2016. And so people really kind of pivoted and moved towards that fracking sand because we had Standing Rock going on at that time. And people were energized around our port and preventing them from continuing to use our port for the shipment of military equipment, for the shipment of big oil infrastructure.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I definitely saw. I saw all that stuff. That was really crazy. Especially because you don't really hear a lot about dope actions against militarism. You know, it's usually just like a done deal, and everybody just shrugs their shoulders. And so it's cool that people who were involved in that were also involved with this. But I guess
And I think like one thing that, you know, like kind of like that is really good about these like series of actions is that it's connecting a lot of like the young like, you know, very like active, like, you know, anarcho and other crowds, to these like older generations who, like, you know, let's say you see them walking around the street, you not, might not realize that this is a person who is like, has a long history of like direct action and stuff like that. But it gets to build those bridges. And I think that, like, you know, the younger, like, you know, more currently active people are getting like a lot of access to like this history and knowledge of like how direct action has happened, how it's been successful, how we can like inoculate ourselves against like repression, like all those sorts of things. So.
And also, like, kind of on the flip side of that, there was definitely a lot of support from the community of people, you know, who presumably otherwise weren't involved in things, showing support in various ways, whether it was like just bringing supplies and food down, or, you know, we were hearing a lot about people calling Steve Hall, the city manager, and like telling him not to raid the camp and all these sorts of things. So a lot of, like, you know, putting that sort of community pressure on the city government to do that. And like I said, just bringing the supplies down and all that sort of thing. So that was really, for me personally, that was like pretty crazy that people were doing that and just like kind of like so immediately jumping and supporting this blockade.
Yeah, well, I mean, especially... Yeah, you go. That's fine.
Oh, I just wanted to point out real quick that... So the Port of Olympia is actually its own municipal body and has its own commissioners and director. So it's a completely separate entity than the city of Olympia. But it was... like the city who made the final call to raid the camp.
Yeah, because the port doesn't have its own police.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. So that's probably beneficial that probably has been beneficial with doing actions there, because it's like this gray area. Right?
And for the most part, at least in some aspects, the port and the city don't get along. So there's a lot of tension there that can be beneficial sometimes.
And not only is there tension, the city actually has a resolution, which is like it's a non-binding resolution that states and asks the port to stop shipping the fracking sands. This was back in, I believe, 2014?
I think
it was either 14. 2012 or 2014 that the city passed this ineffectual resolution that was pretty much like, oh, please don't ship fracking sands through our city anymore. It doesn't align with our city's value. And then the port still continued to have this contract with Rainbow Ceramics and continued to bring in these ships full of proppants. So it's a really interesting dynamic.
Wow.
Yeah, that's the thing.
No, you go. I was just going to make a joke.
No jokes.
My joke was, who would have thought that pressuring city officials to pass a resolution wouldn't work.
Anyway.
Exactly.
You know, it's like, yeah. Who? What? Like, surprise, surprise. You know, they got no backbone. So it's like, but yeah. So, you know, it's really interesting because, like, so last year, you know, when like originally the idea was that people would essentially, that it would be kind of similar to the classic PMR mode of things, where it would be like, where people would like mobilize and like stand in the way of the train, and the train would go back into the port, and then people would dissipate, but then there would be like a skeleton crew, like essentially watching for the train, and then people would mobilize again. But then, like, on the first night, it kind of like people saw that people were standing on the tracks, and then people just delivered stuff. Couches showed up, like tents, like all sorts of stuff just came out of the woodwork. This was last year.
Yeah, last year.
And this happened again this year. But yeah, that kind of gray area that you're mentioning was huge in the fact of like of how long it was able to last. And so, like, last year the camp was in this one spot, and then we had some like interactions with some houseless folks that we were like, okay, we need to move to like give these people like more space because this is their home, right? And so the camp got moved, and, you know, it's almost like kind of with this kind of stuff, you know, you just kind of like keep hacking at it, and that sometimes like that you kind of like hack at it at the right time, at the right place, and it all just kind of works out. And that's really kind of like what happened with this, is the fact that we found this spot in Olympia where it's like we're on the tracks that's not technically the jurisdiction of the Olympia City Police, and they kind of don't want to mess with stuff like as much as possible. And there's like some like possibly part of the reason is that just because like people's resistance to the police here is like is can be pretty ferocious at times. And so I think if the police feel like they can leave something alone, they kind of want to. And so we found this kind of like, you know, no man's land where we're on the tracks. And so they have to, the closest place that the railroad company has to like at their police station or their base of operations is in Oregon. So they had to like drive people up to Oregon to start like surveilling and figuring out what to do. And then they have this whole chain of command that they have to go through to be able to get enough of the departments to like to help out. So it's like the rail police have to ask the stateies, and the stateies have to ask the local police, and then the local police have to ask all the other cities' local police to cover their calls while they try and like raid the camp. And so there's this whole like fallout, and so all that happened just because we kind of accidentally, to a certain degree, wound up in this place where there was like, you know, where we're in this kind of jurisdictional like, you know, hot potato, like everybody's like trying to pass us around, you know. And I think that like, you know, when you're thinking about that kind of stuff even more in the future, and about like, because we think about like the state and these institutions kind of monolithic a lot of times, and that's helpful to like gain an understanding and to like have an analysis. But at the same time, like understanding that there's tensions, you know, it's like during the raid, you know, there was like, you know, the sheriffs were up there like, you know, shit talking like the Olympia Police Department, you know. And like, while obviously I don't think that that's like really an exploitable difference, but like things like that is stuff that I think we should try and agitate more in the future, you know.
Yeah, well, and so one thing I was just noticing as you're talking, it's like you have this institutional memory of older activists, and from what I understand, there were people there who also participated in like bigger actions, like the Mosquito Fleet, where folks were blocking, you know, Shell oil tankers with kayaks a couple years back, and but it's also like it seemed like there was just a bunch of different kind of people there, but like the fact that the cops had like a, you know, that they were a little shook because they're like, oh, it's Olympia. We don't know what the fuck's going to happen if we go in there. And so like that deterrence, the fact that there's like a history of struggle in general, but also militant struggle. I'm sure that also plays to the benefit of the camp's long-term survival. It like adds all these variables in there. So they're like, oh fuck, you know, we can't just go in there and start slapping people around. Like we might get knocked out.
I think you're right. I think a combination between like them not knowing what to expect and that history, and then also of course their desire to just like play with their military toys. You know, they pulled out a lot more stops this time.
Well, yeah, I mean, these guys are like the kind of people whose like entertainment is like dreaming up this like masturbatory home invasion fantasy. And so like they were really excited to like put on their like military BDUs and like AR-15s, and they at points they were pulling down parts of the camp, like tents made of tarps and like pallets that were completely empty, yelling like "Go, go, go, go!" it was absurd.
And they had a bomb squad, for Christ's
sake. Oh yeah, this yeah.
Lord.
And yeah. This was like in an empty camp. Like everybody had already.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
It was empty.
Like yeah. And like this year. Yeah. So like, you know, last year, while they showed up with like a lot of personnel and they showed up with this like big like machinery to tear the camp down and dig out the tracks and all this kind of stuff, like this year they showed up with an MRAP, you know, which is like an armored personnel vehicle that they use in like Afghanistan and stuff like that, you know, and like they showed up with this like massive bomb squad. They had like and last year they had a they had an airplane too, and like and if you want to see the footage, I think it's on like the Oli Stand page of
It's on the Facebook page.
And it's and they actually like last year and this year too, but last year we did some FOIAs and got this heat sensitive like camera on this airplane that was circling above the eviction that was like following people around and stuff like that. So they have that this year plus a helicopter, you know, and it's like, so I think that like this year they were like, I think that they were like much for some reason or another. I don't know. Like, I think like last year when the camp was being evicted, people were able to mount like much more of like a street resistance, and it kind of like extend that like that militancy like out past the camp. Where like this year, but the cost of that was like some arrests. You know, I think that there was about 12 people were arrested last year. Whereas this year, essentially, like we did whatever the hell we wanted for 12 days and got away clean as far as right now. You know?
So, well, also, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but like last year they moved the train pretty much immediately, right? Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think that was like, in my opinion, like the fundamental difference between people sort of like continuing to resist after or during the raid last year and this year was that last year, as soon as it was clear, they escorted the train through the town, and this year they didn't do that until way, way later.
Well, they also had a lot more cleanup time this year too, as far as clearing off the tracks. I mean, I think they spent at least twice the amount of time trying to clear the camp out. It was definitely an epic camp. It was legendary, like
market improvement.
Yeah, like that's the thing is like it's really kind of cool because we actually found some notes from last year. And there was like all this stuff listed, you know, that was like, here's the stuff that we want to do like here's better, essentially. And so it's like, and there was like, and you know, like last year we like wanted to like have music and have workshops and have it bigger and have more tents and like all that. And all of that happened this year. You know, we had like,
we built a library.
Yeah, there was a library. There was like a school, you know, there was like like David Rovics played a local band called Xylitol, like played a punk show, you know, like we had a day of workshops, you know, we like it extended itself out into the street, you know, where there was like this like big, like a ton of bales. And so there was like a front yard and a backyard, you know?
Yeah.
And,
we had the kids up in there playing street hockey and soccer and, yeah. And we had a family tent this year as well, a quiet zone. So that was really cool for our parents.
Yeah,
it seems part of why I wanted to talk to y'all, or why I was excited to talk to y'all about this, is just because it just seemed like so much happened in such a short period of time. Like every day I'd be looking at Twitter and I'd be reading about like, oh, there was a philosophy discussion group today, and oh, we just added this, and one of the, I think it was something Olympia Stand had tweeted, was basically like, you know, it's just kind of like breaking through the alienation and changing the way people related to each other. Can you talk about that element of the occupation? Because I think that's an important thing with occupations is how it kind of like, you know, I don't know, how it changes us, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like most of our lives are just like drudgery and toil. And you know, nothing we do, like for most of us, nothing we like do at, like at work, or in like this scant amount of time that we have to ourselves, quote unquote, like, ever like feels like consequential or fulfilling. Like at least for me, I probably worked the hardest that I have at anything in a year, maybe exactly. in that 12 days, and I like never once didn't have fun. You know,
awesome. And I also say real quick that, like, in terms of like you were saying, new things happening every day and stuff. It's like, I think, at least for myself, I feel like for a lot of us is because that those like, you know, almost 2 weeks felt like a month or more of time. And it was like really, like, you know, afterwards it was just like really almost disoriented about how much time had passed or had not passed.
Yeah, it either could have been one day or like 3 months, you know, but like nothing in between, you know, depending on how you look at it. But yeah, you know, it's like, it's really interesting, you know, because I think that it's so much of our, like, because like the difference between like, you know, a blockade rather than like, or an occupation rather than like, you know, a one-off action or a march or like, you know, like, or more like clandestine, like attacks, you know, is the fact that you're like holding space and you're opening it up so that we can like create exactly those types of like new dynamics. And then, you know, for me, it was like very much everything about what I was doing during those 12 days was oriented not around this, like this ethereal idea or these like ethereal, like, you know, politics that I think that I have, or like this, like, you know, kind of like that informs like these series of actions I take. But everything was oriented around a physical place where it's like, where like maybe I saw like some of those like values being seen and maybe sometimes not. But the fact is that there was like, it opened up this world of possibility of like living out those types of things and doing it together. And like, and that's the thing, I was like, there was, you know, there was a lot of different like different like ideas and perspectives and groups like participating in this blockade, you know, whereas in years previous and kind of like the other, like as far as like the lineage that this action is coming from is like a lot of those actions were a little bit more like, you know, focused and specific, and there was like a little bit more lead up to it. This year, it just kind of like, you know, there was like a little bit of lead up to it, but it was more just like saying, like people putting out like, hey, this is going to happen.
Yeah, we're going to do it.
We're going to do it. And so then all the groups like, you know, coming together on like without kind of like much like inertia of like the blockade made like a really interesting like space for like, you know, and sometimes it wasn't always great. You know, I mean, like it wasn't perfect. And there was like definitely like internal power dynamics that people that I think that, but I think that actually like the community in Olympia, because we like went through this practice of holding this space together and trying to like work with each other, like across tendencies and like all this type of stuff. Like, I think that we're really figuring out how to work together much better and understand like the ways in which that we can like, you know, like our differences make us like, you know, stronger and more dynamic and less, and like, it's much harder to like for the state to like handle us and mold us in certain ways, you know?
Yeah.
And so it's like, it's, yeah, I don't know. It's really interesting.
Yeah. And I mean, just like, the nature, like basically like what they were saying, like the nature of the blockade, of a blockade or an occupation versus like a specific action, like a protest, is like you are around people like in their downtime. And when they're not like, you know, and you're like, you're living communally together with a bunch of people. And so like, all of these, like maybe like until now, like, theoretical ideas about communal living, like you have to put them into practice. You know, sometimes it sucks because nobody wants to do the dishes.
Amen.
Or
amen.
Like,
fuck dishes.
Or clean up the cardboard, you know. You know, it's like,
right.
Or, you know, yeah. Or wash the blankets.
or roll the spliffs. Somebody's got to roll the spliffs.
Somebody's got to roll.
I think there's always volunteers for that.
Although we have to say that, like, you know, there's some cigarette companies out there that have stopped putting out papers on their cigarettes. It's creating a crisis in our community that we have to address. And I'm sure a lot of people know what I'm talking about, you know. That's all. That's all about that.
Yeah, another real quick one is I know that a lot of people stopped quitting smoking as soon as the blockade started.
Oh, yeah.
and so yeah, myself included. So I'm now having to quit again. But yeah.
Well, I can give you plenty of tips for that after the interview. I just recommend a lot of hot baths, a lot of exercise, a little magnesium. You'll be fine.
Ooh, there you go.
Nice.
Yeah,
nice.
We did. There was one of the workshops was a Jaint workshop, you know, which was like a, I can't remember what it stands for. Essentially a rolling workshop. So, you know.
Oh, yeah.
I should have been at that workshop.
Yeah, I was surprised by the number of people who did not know how to roll a cigarette. But you know, I'll say that, you know, in terms of like kind of what you were saying before about like relating to people and building those bonds, like that, you know, ideally is like the great thing about these sorts of situations with the blockade is that like you have, you know, like we were saying before, a lot of people of different, you know, political persuasions and such, and also like people who are maybe like new to this and are passionate or they want to get involved or something, and you know, a lot of there might also be a lot of you know, this place is not like really that big of a town, and so there are people that you know, and there's you know, perhaps like past issues, you know, whether good or bad, and these sorts of things. But when you're like sort of there on the line and you know, things get put more into like a clear perspective, when you can like have disagreements about things but then like still see people like doing the work that needs to be done, and like the level of respect that comes with that both ways. So I think that was like a really important thing for people sort of like getting past, in my mind, what aren't really that importance of differences and like working together, and hopefully also like that helps in the future as well.
Yeah, and that's what downtimes are for. You know, that's when everybody can attack each other, is during the downtimes. You know? when they came to break up the camp, there was like everybody just left. Can you talk about that decision to not physically resist? Or how that just like were there discussions about this in advance? Like, were people like, look, we accomplished enough, you know, let's not have the felonies? Or I'm just interested in hearing kind of like what those discussions were like and how y'all, you know, arrived at that decision.
There were discussions about it, and I think the sentiment that was being like put forward by a lot of people was that the sort of like burden on the community in terms of supporting arrestees like through the legal process was just kind of not worth it. I mean, there were people who are still wrapping up their trials for the previous blockade more than a year ago. And so, like, people generally felt that arrest wasn't worth it. You know, the couple hours longer that it would delay clearing the blockade was not worth the year-long legal process and then the follow-up, like, someone being on probation and basically being, like, unable to participate in any sort of, like, thing that might risk arrest. So I think that was like everybody's kind of general like concern and like decision.
And I think that was like there was a couple like distinct differences between like last year and this year, and like, yeah, one of them was like last year it was like very much ambiguous as far as like different choices that people were going to make, like, or they were like, I don't like, nobody was like, you know, like staging arrests, but like, were people going to like, you know, physically like not going to leave until they like, you know, cut a chain or like, you know, physically like remove me from the space, you know, or like whatever. Like that was like, that was stuff from last year. And this year, yeah, it was very much like there was like the culture of the group was like, yeah, don't get arrested
And like last year, I think that a lot of people had sort of a last stand mentality that was like that they like, even when like it was like clear that there was no point in sticking around, that they did anyway. And like, so like what like we kind of tried to do this year was like, like when the raid did come, just like finding everybody in camp being like, hey, you know, you don't have to stay here.
And we had meetings about this as well, or it came up in the GA where people talked about it, and we really did a cost benefit analysis and had the group discuss it. I feel multiple nights, in preparation for the raid, because we're on edge most time. You know, you don't know, is it coming tonight? Is the raid not coming tonight? There'll be rumors that it's happening. You know, all this stuff, and so just really continually having these conversations with our comrades and at the GA, I think was also very different this year than last year. And I mean, we don't need a last stand because, you know,
because
we'll just do it again.
I think for the most part, it was the general consensus that like, it just wasn't practical. Like there wasn't really much point in like, you know, sort of either resisting for sure in that sense, or like, you know, doing like a, you know, sitting down, and not leaving until being removed. Because as we were saying, it just wasn't really going to do much other than like, you know, catch cases for people.
Yeah. And like, and the thing about it is that like, you know, if you think about it, like tactically, you know, it just doesn't, it's like essentially like, you know, in you really want to like attack like on your own turf, you know, and you don't really want to defend on like other people's turf, you know? And so essentially like we had attacked and created our own turf in those moments of like creating the blockade and taking that space and kind of like, you know, creating our own like turf through that. But then like essentially like, you know, when they show up like in force, it's like, it's essentially, it's their, it's like, it's kind of like, you know, like they're the ones who are like deciding like what it, like where and when that conflict happens. And if we choose not to like, you know, like have that conflict when they want to have it, when they're ready for it, that's like a pretty smart choice in my opinion. And I mean, that was definitely like, you know, I think that this year there definitely was, it's not like people just like, you know, walked out of camp and they did just kind of walk out of camp. You know, I mean, there was like not that many people there when the cops actually showed up. But like there was still like, you know, there was still like a presence there, you know, like we didn't like, you know, like definitely like, you know, we didn't let them get away completely free. Like, that was, you know, we were heckling them and like, you know, and like kind of running around, you know, like, but like kind of with like less intensity than in last year, you know, but there was definitely like some level of like trying to like, you know, kind of mess with them while we can, you know, but in a way where it's like, yeah, where they're not allowed, where we're kind of like resisting their want to like extract resources from our community.
Yeah. And to extend that metaphor, the courts are the state's turf for sure. They're just like a fucking Sarlacc pit that ends in like prison slavery. So like, avoiding having to fight in like against the state in the courts is like,
But you know, one thing I just, you know, y'all kept that for like 2 weeks. And so at the end of 2 weeks, it's easy to be like, hey, you know what? We accomplished quite a bit. Let's cut our losses here. But any night, any moment, you know, you don't have control over the state. Like they, you know, anybody could have been arrested at any point. And I'm sure that like that calculus probably changed from the beginning towards the end, because when you occupy some shit, you know, you're putting your body on the line. And so just to kind of underline that,
I think most of us also thought that the first day that like, we would all get busted right away.
Yeah.
And so that, you know, yeah, that was definitely, so it definitely changed over time.
Yeah. I think, I mean, also it's like took an enormous amount of like emotional, like physical, like infrastructure to like maintain this space as best we could. And so it was like, definitely, you know, there's part of it. There's part of it where I've wondered if did they leave us that long so that there would be less resistance when they wanted to evict the camp? You know, is like, that's something that I've wondered. Like, you know, I think that I'm really excited to see what we can find, like doing lots of FOIAs, you know, and to see maybe if they had any sort of strategy to that. Was it like the infighting of the different like pillars of the state that was like that caused it to go on for so long? You know, I mean, yeah, exactly. But I think that, yeah, if they had tried earlier, there definitely, I think, would have been more energy put towards that, possibly.
I'm sorry, what?
Oh, it's okay. Go ahead.
No, it's fine. What were you going to say?
I was going to say that FOIAs were actually pretty instrumental in this blockade and the last blockade. And we did FOIA after the last blockade and did look at internal emails and phone logs and such between the city and the port. And that actually gave us insight into how the raid in 2016 went down, which gave us a lot of information. And so the FOIA and the research and making sure you understand who you're dealing with, who are the government, who are the corporations, is really important in this type of activism and in this type of blockade. So,
right. And for people who don't know what that means, it's the Freedom of Information Act. Anybody can file one in different local organization, you know, in like the city in Colorado, you have the Colorado Open Records or, and yeah, I mean, you can get so much information just FOIAing shit. And so that's a, you know, for people who are listening, it's like, that's just a wealth of information, and talk about shaking a tree and seeing what falls out. But it's cool to hear that y'all actually use that for, operational, I don't know what operational data, intel.
Surveillance.
Yeah, counter surveillance. Yeah, yeah. I encourage, like, I haven't really seen, like, nearly enough of, like, for people being comfortable with FOIAing stuff as I have kind of here in Oli. And, yeah, and I encourage everybody. It's like, even if you just, like, even if it's a march, even if it's just, like, even if there's no action and you're curious if, like, the organization you're working with, like, you know, is under surveillance, you know, like there's definitely some organizations like in town that we've FOIA'd on other stuff that we've been like, oh, we didn't even think that we were like on their radar. And like, and essentially we are, you know? And so, you know, it's just like, yeah, everybody, it's really easy. You know, there's like easy tutorials, you know, just like, yeah, really I encourage everybody to get comfortable with that. I think that it's a vastly underutilized tool for sure.
Yeah, kind of like what you were saying, that every time you have an event or every time you have a march or every time you have any sort of activism that's happening, you need to be FOIAing that through your police department, through your city government. If there's a fusion center, any and all governmental agencies that can be FOIAed that could have been involved within your action, you should be FOIAing them.
Yeah.
Like, hands down, that should be number one thing you do after part of your debrief. And then you should also then have more meetings about it and talk about what did we find, what do they know, what is their strategy, and that can help you then move on to your next project.
Yeah,
that's amazing. I've never thought about doing that.
Yeah, and you can FOIA yourself too. You know, if you want to know, like, you can also FOIA like stuff around like certain actions and stuff like that. But you can also FOIA like yourself and be like, you know, are they, you know, why? And then, you know, yeah, just kind of like what you, I mean, you know, and maybe that's a good thing, because then we can, because I think we're all like, can be pretty paranoid people, you know, understandably so. And so maybe you can kind of give us like a little bit more of like a reasonable like scope in which to like think about those things, you know.
And
it's like Googling yourself.
Yeah, exactly.
And in specifics to the Olympia blockade of 2016, so the Oli Stan blockade, some comrades did a FOIA request, and they actually figured out that Halliburton was the buyer of the province that was blockaded last year in 2016. And we cost Halliburton two different fracking operations due to the delaying of the train. And not only did it get delayed here by a blockade, but because of the schedule for the conductors, as soon as it left Olympia, it went up to Tacoma and sat in Tacoma for another couple weeks before it was actually able to make it out to Wyoming. And so how we figured out who the buyer of the sands was is this document called the Bill of Lading, which is pretty much like your sales receipt that you can get for any shipment that's coming in and out of port, whether it be by train or sea or whatever. So the Bill of Lading is a great way to figure out who is moving stuff through my port, where is it going to, where is it coming from.
That's amazing. And I mean, especially because it's not, you know, it's like, it seems like such an abstract thing, like, oh my, Olympia, you know, but like, once you understand the flows of how these things are getting, you know, it's like, you know, cause a lot of, you know, we still have people who will march against capitalism and stand in the street and yell at an empty building and, you know, they attacked capitalism. But when you actually know, like, this is going here, this is doing this. You know, it's actually, and you know, it's having an impact, and then you can verify it. That's really cool.
I mean, if you think about
the mechanism of capitalism.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. And if we stopped all mechanisms of capitalism within each like community, and they all stopped all shipments of big oil infrastructure, if we have the targets and those are clearly defined, I mean, we have a chance at this.
Yeah, exactly. Like I think that it serves us so well to like really like. Yeah, learn the infrastructure and focus in on our targets, you know, because, yeah, just like you're saying, I mean, like, you know, there's like the May Day marches and kind of like that have, and like those do have an impact. I mean, like May Day in Seattle, you know, these days, I mean, like they have to like all of the downtown businesses close, and they hire like Nike hires guards to like stand out in one in front of every window, you know, so it's like you do cost them in a certain way. But also I think that like as far as like, kind of like finding these more like specific, like targeted places. And then like, you know, and then why you're doing that, opening up this space, you know, it's like, I don't know. It hits on so many levels. And I think that it's like, I don't know, it has the possibility of being like very effective, you know, and there's so many different places. And it's like, I can almost guarantee that wherever you're listening at this from, there is some like important piece of infrastructure, like where you live, that you can like find out, research about, find out how it plays into the thing, and find out how you can disrupt that. You know, it's like, that's like everywhere, you know, and it doesn't take, I mean, there's like lots of, and like, you know, obviously this action, like Olympia kind of punches above its weight, as people say, like as far as like for the amount of population and the amount of radicals that are here. But like, you know, you don't need like, you know, you can kind of like look at communiques from other like, you know, parts of resistance, and there's all different ways you can do it. And it just takes a little bit of like research and discipline.
I mean, the first train blockade had 10 people that originally blocked the train, and yeah, then it grew from there. I mean, it doesn't, you don't need tons and tons and tons of people to start with. People will come.
Yeah.
Once you do the thing. So. Yeah.
And in terms of like blocking infrastructure, it's like, I mean, PMR was around before this, but like the highway blockade that like Black Lives Matter like popularized in America in like the recent like decade, highways much more so even than train lines are like the veins of capitalism. That's where like most goods are shipped is with trucks. And I mean, like, they're full of cars and trucks that spit poison into the air.
I'd say too, like, you know, in terms of understanding these things with like these different companies and where stuff is being moved to, another important aspect of that in terms of capitalism is that it, like, when people come to understand these things, it sort of demystifies it. And like we were saying before with the police and the government, that we tend to see them as being monolithic when really they're not. And it's the same with capitalism, where like we see it as being very daunting and for sure it is, but at the same time, it's like made up of all these like, you know, kind of small bits and pieces that, you know, contrary to what they say, very inefficiently fit together. And so like understanding like how those, you know, some of those pieces work or just, you know, it really demystifies it. And you can see where the sort of like choke points are for these goods moving around. And a lot of times, like just due to the very nature of how they set these up, like there's a lot of like choke points.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I just thought like fracking operated with like this big straw that goes under the ground and it spits some shit in, sucks it out. Like now I know what a proppant is, you know? So.
Well, and that's the thing right. Exactly. I mean, if you think about it, like the slurry that goes through the straw, I mean, that's coming in from like, I mean, there's more research that we could do. I mean, that's coming in from all sorts of different places, you know? So like, who knows? I mean, maybe, you know, there's like, there's other coordination that can happen where it's like, you know, if like the Olympia blockade comes back up, then like, you know, then somebody else blocks like the other chemical. And then so, you know, because it's like, it's a whole disgusting slurry that they
pump
in there.
Oh, yeah. They use like benzenes and nasty stuff. So,
yeah. And I think, and you know, one thing that was really cool is that, you know, with the blockade and just thinking about, you know, how all these things interact and whatever is that, like, you know, we also had like, you know, an indigenous caucus that was like really big in this blockade. And like, and so it's not only is it connected to all these like, you know, physical pieces of infrastructure that are like physically ruining the world we live in, you know, but like also there's all these other like, you know, social, I mean, that and to a certain degree, physical intersections that are happening where it's like, you know, the indigenous caucus was able to speak really powerfully on how like the man camps that are created around these like oil infrastructures, like facilitate like the disappearance of indigenous women, you know, and like the major bits of prostitution that are happening and like, and so like, and like, and how like, you know, there's also like in this area, we're on like the Medicine Creek Treaty Tribes land and
specifically the Nisqually and Squaxin Island tribes.
Yeah. And so like, and essentially they, you know, don't like, they're really trying to like advocate and like strong arm the city and the port and the railroads to have like say what goes through their treaty lands. Cause right now they don't, they're kind of like, you know, just pushed to the side in all these negotiations. And actually, it's something that's really crazy that like the city and the port and the railroad company did these last 2 years is so like last year, the railroad company actually was sending out a negotiator from somewhere in the Midwest to negotiate with a lawyer that we had and that was going to meet with the indigenous caucus last year to like have a discussion about like indigenous rights and something like that. And 12 hours before that meeting was supposed to happen was when the camp was raided. And that unbelievable. Like the amount of disrespect is just like, you know, flooring. I mean, no surprise, but it's like always like, sucks every time, you know. And this year the same thing happened with the port essentially
and the city.
The port and the city were supposed to meet with the indigenous caucus and other tribal leaders from like from the surrounding tribes
that came and drove out hours
to have this meeting and then the city, you know, and then the camp got raided again almost like 12 hours right beforehand, you know. And so it's just like, and so,
and
yeah.
And they canceled the meeting.
And they canceled the meeting. Yeah, meeting didn't happen either time. Yeah. And so it's just like, you know, it's so insane, like the way that, like, you know, I don't know. That's just like all part of it. And just like understanding how it's like, you know, how like, you know, these spaces like create like ability to like, you know, flex ourselves into all these intersections, you know.
That's fucking sad. You know,
yeah,
that's. Like, I mean, it's just like adding insult to injury. It's like, that doesn't even make, from the perspective of like a capitalist PR firm, it's like, have the evict after the meeting, you know? It's like, God.
Yeah, exactly. And so that's the stuff that, you know, that I think that like are like, you know, connections and collaboration that we've created, you know, with some of these people. It's stuff that I'm really excited about, like, you know, moving forward, you know, because I think that like not only with like were there other lots of strong like connections made with like other anarchists and, you know, anti-capitalists and stuff like that, but also, you know, with like with some local indigenous tribes and like people like who kind of formed themselves as an indigenous caucus, kind of like, you know, of like Oli Stand. And so it's like, you know, it's all those connections that right, that we, you know, it's like you don't get that if you just go out to a march and, you know, you chant your slogans, you know, and then you kind of like, you don't like kind of like get past that to where you're kind of sitting down and being like, oh, here's a person that I've seen around for years, but only like at like activism things, you know, or whatever. So, yeah, it's huge. I mean, and it's totally fucked that they do that, you know. I mean, and that's like, and that's the stuff that we just got to like hammer along, you know. It's like we can't let them get away with that kind of shit. So, yeah.
You know, and it's totally possible too, like not justifying it at all, but that, like, you know, speaking of like not being monolithic, that they are probably having these like internal fights then, you know, on their side of things. And so in terms of like being like, oh, we're going to meet with you and then raiding it, like, I wouldn't be surprised if there were like, you know, different groups at play on their side who were pushing to like have some sort of like diplomatic thing, and another group within them trying to say like, oh, we'll just raid them and, you know, crack their heads, and you know, and all in the process of making themselves look stupid.
Yeah. You know, there was like, yeah, so essentially, and that plays out even in the, like, the port commissioners, because on one side you have this port commissioner Zita, who was like, you know, she's a liberal, whatever. She wanted to meet with the indigenous caucus. Like, she kind of voiced like, you know, I mean, she's a greasy politician, but she also voiced like dissent against, like, you know, against like violently evicting the camp, you know. And then and then literally you have like Joe Downing in the middle, who's like just greasy politician. And then you have McGregor on the left, who he's kind of like
admittedly greasy.
And McGregor is like, yeah, he's like basically the whole time during like the port commissioner meeting during the blockade, he was like, the rule of law, that's what I believe in. I believe in the rule of law. And so even in there, but the most, I think one of the great moments was when McGregor kind of like found like the long silly list of demands that people had put out, and kind of like started to take them seriously. And he's like, you know, he's trying to use this to like discredit.
Where was this at, like a meeting or something? A public meeting?
Yeah. So there was like, the port commissioner and city council meeting both happened when the blockade was going. And so like, they were like, you know, so the room got packed with a bunch of like, you know, activists and the indigenous caucus spoke and like all that kind of stuff. And so McGregor like pulls out these demands, and he's like, you know, and like they first of all, I listened to this podcast and they're having fun down there. They're ordering pizzas. During a dance party, he was just like so upset that people were like, oh, like smiling at all down there. You know why they like disrupt like his favorite train line or whatever. and he was just like so upset, and he's just like the perfect just like old curmudgeon, like he's such a great guy to hate on, you know. And like, and so, and then he starts like reading off this list of demands, and the room just starts laughing at him, you know. And he's like, because, and I think then he realized like what a doofus he was making himself out to be, like just kind of like, they want to blow up the sun, they want, and then there's like the, like what we want our skeletons to be made out of, and he's like, I can't even pronounce this word.
Adamantium.
Yeah, he wants adamantium. I don't know what that, you know. And so it's just like, so, you know, so they, you know, so anyway, but point being that like even within like, you know, it's like these are like the differences that we got to learn how to exploit better, you know. And it's like, I think that a lot of times we just want to like ignore them because like we don't like want to like vote, and like, all that's kind of like sucks or whatever, but like at the same time, like when they're in power, we should know like the different levers that we can pull to manipulate the situation to our benefit, you know. And I think that, you know, that's something that like, you know, I ignore a lot, but I saw in this like specific blockade like how like useful that can be, you know. Just they're all tools,
and you can actually figure out a bunch of the internal riffraff between port commissioners or between the city through FOIAing emails. You can FOIA just their entire email, and then it's like reading a soap opera, and you're just ready for the next person to go ahead and just be like bashing on Zita because they all like to pick on Zita. So it's really interesting, and you can figure out these dynamics between the commissioners and then exploit those dynamics.
I noticed in some of the photos, there's a lot of these green green baklavas. And I actually, like, one of my good friends is part of this group, Demand Utopia in Portland. Is this like some Murray Bookchin shit going on down there too?
That's some Murray Bookchin shit.
Yeah.
So was that specifically like Demand Utopia was involved with this, or was this like some other Bookchinite factions at work down here? Like, what's going on?
There was definitely like people like associated with the ideas of Bookchin for sure. And then
he's got a posse for sure.
Yeah. and then I think with the picture that you're referring to, yeah, I mean, I think the people, as far as I understand, the people in that picture are part of that.
Well, yeah, no, there was definitely like Demand Utopia was definitely like one of the many groups that was like working in support of the blockade for sure. And like, and you know, and they, yeah, they, you know, they're kind of, I mean, I like them, you know, they kind of like really try and like, you know, like mix things up in a way, like, you know, like one of their members like went to city council and then pulled on the green mask and like and spoke like as a Martian, you know, and like saying
as a diplomat from the Federation
of Mars, basically saying how like, you know, on Mars they created this egalitarian society where like, you know, like exploitation by one Martian from another has been abolished, and like as well as like extraction industries, and you should listen. And so,
but that they had made a lot of mistakes in the past and that they didn't want to see Earth repeat those same mistakes.
Yeah. So, and that was the great thing about the blockade is like talk about like a diversity of tactics. Like that really happened here. You know?
Also, a funny thing with that like speech thing was that the newspaper here, the Olympian, is like the local newspaper, and it's like a terrible, terrible newspaper.
Oh yeah.
And they, one of the articles that they wrote about the blockade and everything, where they also talked about that city council meeting where this person spoke as a Martian representative, they ended the article with like quoting him and from what he said in the city council meeting. And it was just like perfect because almost like they must have inadvertently did it, but they like made it sound really great because they like basically gave the last word to this Martian. And so it turned out pretty well.
Yeah. That's awesome. I could just talk to you about this forever, but one question I definitely want to ask, especially for other people who are looking to replicate this sort of thing, is part A of that question is, you know, how were decisions made, or how were they not made, or like how were decisions made in the camp, and what advice would you have other than FOIA stuff to people looking to replicate projects like this?
Yeah. No, and I think like that's actually kind of like a really big issue that we kind of as a community honestly have yet to figure out. As far as like the decisions in camp. I mean, like as far as setting up the blockade, you know, it's like, you know, do your research, you know, like find out what the choke points are. If you can, like try and like find out like jurisdictional questions as far as like who has jurisdiction on what thing and like how can you like outgrow their capacity, right? Because essentially like a reason that it worked the first year is because the camp was able to outgrow the rail police's capacity, which is pretty small because they're pretty spread out over the country, capacity to evict the camp like right away. And so once you have your camp set up, like a decision making structure, I honestly like recommend that you put like a lot more like thought and like discussion into like what that's gonna be like beforehand. Because I think that like essentially like the thing that we ran into is there was like a lot of different like assumptions that people were bringing to the table, and like those assumptions didn't get a chance to get hashed out except for when people were trying to make those decisions. And so it kind of like, so then a lot of people brought those assumptions to the moment when those decisions were trying to be made. And that's not when you want to decide how you're going to or not going to make decisions. You know
what? Let me cut you off real quick. What can you give me an example of what you mean by that?
Yeah.
Any
yeah.
A simple one.
A big one was on, like, not necessarily, like, a list of demands, but, like, points of unity, like, things that we all agreed on, and, like, sort of public messaging to, like, people outside of the blockade,
like how we were going to present it.
Right, and, like, basically what happened was that, some people wanted to, establish points of unity, and, some people were just, absolutely against that idea at all, and, even of, making that decision, in general assemblies, in meetings, and so, there were, pretty much, people, operating on, entirely different assumptions about, what we could decide as a group, and, that kind of stuff, and, yeah.
Yeah, I think, and one thing too is that, in my opinion, what happened a lot of times is when a decision came up in a meeting, then the whole assumptive thing is sort of, in my opinion, speaking about how, we would be talking about one thing, but really it would be about something else. And so, there would be a discussion about, they were saying about whether we should have demands or not, or whether we should, have points of unity or not. But then, the actual underlying discussion was about, whether we could even make collective decisions that would speak for everybody as a group or not. And so there was kind of a lot of, and so that made things difficult because, some people would be sort of speaking to the superficial issue and some people would be speaking to the kind of underlying issue. And we didn't have a framework to make these decisions and that was a real issue, basically.
Yeah.
to put it mildly.
Yeah, exactly. And I actually really think that it was that was to a certain degree, detrimental on a number of levels in the camp. You know, it's there were certain communiques that were released, so essentially the people just said, well, whatever, do whatever you want, And essentially that it just didn't really work that well. I mean, obviously it worked well enough and that's pretty good. But I think that there was a question with whether people were satisfied with how the camp was functioning or if people thought it could be better. And I'm definitely in the camp where I thought that we could have done a number of things better. And one of those was people were very kind of distrustful of this idea of having a media team, a team that gets together that has essentially a mouthpiece to speak for the camp. And I think actually that's a pretty reasonable thing to be worried about. But we can re-envision these things. a media team could just be the team that essentially the point of the team is to get people together who want to release media independently to have them at least have conversations with each other, to process things with each other. And not necessarily to say you can or can't do that, but essentially to be the people who are bottom lining conversations with people who want to release media and stuff like that.
Just to facilitate better communication.
Exactly. Facilitate better communication. And it's and another example of that is a greeting team. We tried to really push that in a cultural way to start having us have a culture of a greeting team. When people come in the door, you say, hey, how you doing? Here's what the camp is about. And I think that that was not good in a couple of ways. The fact that we couldn't really get organized, because I think that people who are pushing back, who are against demands, and I'm not against any of these ideas philosophically. I think that sometimes they make sense, but at the same time, the people who are pushing back against demands, against having a media team, also I think then people were scared to put forward any sort of ideas of organization, And so, like, let's say if we wanted to have, like, a very structured, organized way in which you welcome people into camp, making sure that there was a welcoming committee, you know, actually would have made us safer, because it would have, because essentially, like, you know, if, like, let's say we have an infiltrator that's wanting to come into camp, you know, if, like, if they get a lot of attention right off the bat, that's probably, they're not going to be as interested in, like, engaging with that, you know, and, like, and also if they're getting a lot of attention, like, they're, you know, it's like, and they're asking, like, oh, hey, who's the leader? Y'all want to smoke some weed, you know, and, like, stuff like that. About that sooner, you know.
Or like, what's, like, more common is either, like, some, like, reactionary person or just, like, I mean, this is a little out of the way for the kind of where it was, but, like, some, like drunk passerby from, like, a bar. Like, it's like when people, when you like say hi to people and like wave and like somebody who may be like aggressive at first is going to be like a little disarmed. And, so it like, it's kind of like the first like measure of security against like any sort of like random, like reactionary person who might be like violent.
Or yeah. You know, yeah, they read on, you know, they read on InfoWars that you were a bunch of like white hating George Soros maniacs who want to kill everybody, you know, and then they meet you and they're like, "Whoa, they're, these Soros stooges sure are nice," you know, yeah. Like
for those Soros checks to
clear. Have you has your check cleared there about those Soros?
Hell yeah.
Figure that out, but I don't know. They just haven't been working. Like, you know, maybe we should call Alex Jones. He seems to know a lot about it. I don't know. You know, and like the I think the other really important piece with that like greeting team and like that need, in my opinion, for like more like focused organization and like non hierarchical, obviously, but like a little bit more organization is the camp is like obviously we had a ton of like street people and homeless people who came into the camp, you know, and like, and essentially we had no vehicle in which to communicate to them like, hey, guess what, this, by being here, like you are putting yourself at a greater risk than just being out there, and those people are definitely like way more at risk than those of us who have like better support networks, houses, like stuff and all that kind of stuff. And that was one thing that I was really disappointed on. And obviously, like a lot of the street cats, you know, they come from a very different culture than a bunch of like, you know, anarchists, anti-capitalists. And the only tool that we had to like share that culture with them was telling them to like get the fuck out or like shove them away when they were like being like sexist, racist, misogynist, like all these, like if they're being aggressive and all these things, you know. And so, but essentially, if we had like a little bit of like a facilitation of like bringing these people into camp, saying like, hey, here's the deal with the camp. Just so you know, like that you're under a little bit more surveillance here. There's more cops that are going to be pressuring here. This is technically an illegal thing. And hey, by the way, here's things that are like really important. Like don't like, and it kind of like give them like a 101 on like anti-capitalism, like, you know, like not to be like, you know, transphobic, like racist, like all these types of things, and give them like a chance to succeed so that our only tool isn't just telling people, isn't just like call out culture, which is so needs to be dealt with, that's our only tool that we have to keep our community safe. Like we also need to create avenues for people to like succeed in our communities and like giving people the ground rules and saying like, hey, like this is the culture that we want to create. Like you have the, you were like, you have an opportunity to be part of that culture before like you bump into this invisible line that you've never run into before, and then you get kicked out, you know. And so like a couple of these things all came back to the fact that like we could, like people felt like uncertain about like making demand or making decisions in the GA, and the GA is like a terrible model. We need to figure out something different as far as like how to like get a group working together, you know. Maybe a GA is one of the tools, but we need other ones too.
It also, I mean, it wasn't a model. Just to be clear, that I mean, the even calling it a GA or a General Assembly was just started happening. It was basically a meeting.
It's a generous application of the term for sure.
But also another, I think another aspect is really just like, yeah, having more solid communication, because, you know, one thing that would happen would be, to a greater or lesser extent, you know, rumors about things would start. So, you know, there'd be something like maybe that there would be a raid or something, you know, generally something of that nature or something to do with the authorities, you know, and there would be, you know, somebody who knew something would say something to somebody else, and then it would just like spin out of control. And since there was like no avenue for sort of like disseminating information and like processing information, then like certain rumors could become very dangerous and toxic, you know, because like you would hear something and then be like, oh wait, is this really true? Like, is this really going on? And actually it like wasn't true at all. You know, and that happened like several times with me personally, where like I knew like I had some piece of information, and then it would like go around this chain and come back to me in this really distorted form. And then, you know, after a minute I'd be like, wait a minute, no, I know about this. Like, now that I understand what you're talking about, that's like totally not what's going on. And so it was really important to try and like, you know, nip those things in the bud, like as quickly as possible before people started like just passing on these rumors, you know? So that was important, you know, something that could have been mitigated had we had a better like structure of communication.
This is all great stuff. I mean, I really like the greeting thing because I just feel like in general, radical spaces could do with being a little kinder and more empathetic and, as you put it, giving people a room, you know, some room to succeed. And I feel like some of this is like, you know, still like responding to Occupy and, you know, General Assembly is just becoming the thing in itself and people making speeches and it just turns into a bunch of bullshit where like some asshole shows up at fucking noon, nobody votes on some shit, and the next thing you know, like, it's... So, I mean, I definitely empathize with, you know, that critique of decision-making, but I think, you know, there's certainly a lot of gray area to play with in new ways of figuring out how to do shit. But I don't think... I mean, I certainly haven't found a better way. Like, we've tried various... experiments with decision making, and they all tend to produce the same results so far.
Yeah.
So, well, I don't know. Is there anything else we missed that you think people should know about the Olympia Soros Foundation?
That's the official title, actually.
Yeah. That's what our nonprofits found. Like, yeah.
Yeah. We still haven't gotten paid for it.
Yeah.
Oh man.
I mean,
we covered a lot of it.
Yeah.
You know, we did it, and you can too. You know? I mean, like I guess one thing that I want to say is like it was fucking awesome. You know, it's like you know, like it, I mean, like I definitely like the day after I like. You know, I've oscillated between like just like so relieved and just like on the verge of tears because I miss it so much. You know, I think that we all have like a blockade sized hole in our heart, you know, and I think that's kind of interesting because it's almost like now we know that like that we really now we maybe have a closer idea of like the kind of world that we want and like. We know that we want something like that again, you know, and I think that like, and so it like, I think it really, I don't know, that's good. Like we should get addicted to like this, like that kind of stuff, you know, of like, we just want it so bad that we're just going to keep pushing for it, you know, until it goes down. It goes
yeah,
down.
Yeah. Yeah. like speaking to like the difficulty of making decisions. I mean, we're building a community that's like horizontal and like egalitarian, and we're like doing it like in defiance of like the state, which like which you know is like never gonna give us a break, but like all the same, it's like. It's difficult, but it's joyful, and like if we were doing this, like if you know, if we were having to do these things, like make decisions and whatever, like without the like external pressure of like the, you know, the, like the threat of being raided at any minute, like it would be much different.
Yeah.
I mean, and not only that, I heard that from one of the parents that their toddler, they went to the site after the blockade had been raided, and the toddler was devastated. The toddler just went, wait, where did the blockade go? And this is like a four-year-old. It was just absolutely couldn't comprehend why anybody would take that place down. He's like, I had so much fun there, and it was just everybody liked me there, and it was beautiful. And so this toddler was absolutely devastated, and you know, I think we're all a little sad that we missed the blockade. Yeah. You could go down there. You knew where everybody was. You didn't have to text anybody those 12 days. You just went to the blockade because like everybody's going to be there.
Yeah, and it's intergenerational too. I mean, you know, I can't go to meetings anymore, you know, because I have a kid now. So it's like I could have participated in the blockade with my kid. So,
meetings need to get childcare.
Yeah.
No, I know.
Okay, you should hammer them. So. Yeah,
so
did my kid.
No, I'm just using that as an excuse. I actually don't want to go to meetings at all right now.
Damn, too real. But you know, well, it's something I definitely want to give a shout out is to like all the sick solidarity actions that went down. You know, I don't know if people are following it, but like big shout out to the people in the Bay Area. You know, like that was, it was like so dope. So like Xylitol, which is this like punk hardcore band, was playing at the blockade, and like all like we were kind of like, whoa, where did all these punks come from? Like, why aren't they at the blockade every day? You know, but whatever. And so like they were all showing up, and like they were playing, and they were like a really awesome local band. And then like it's like they stopped playing, and then somebody like, you know, read out the fact that like, you know, people had like shut down rail lines in the Bay Area in solidarity, and then they launched right into another song, you know. So it was like those magic moments were so awesome, and they were able to happen because we felt connected to like a larger struggle. So like big ups to like, you know, the banner drops and all the like, you know, acts of solidarity like that.
People ordering pizza.
We had so many pizzas ordered. Oh, the pizza delivery guy would just show up and be like, pizza, and just yeah. Something for it. Yeah, I was like, hell yeah.
The pizza flowed freely.
Oh my god, yeah. I know, like now
they left us the warming bags at one point in time. They just dropped them all off.
Oh, and then it was the first night because there was like 10 pizzas that showed up, and they just left the warming bags and all. It was great.
Yeah, and so it's like, you know, and that's like the thing, is like there's been like times where like everybody's like, I didn't pay for food for 12 days. You know, it's like we were literally just fed, you know.
And we had the sickest kitchen. That kitchen was beautiful. Yeah, exactly. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. But then you had excess food, and you were able to distribute resources to houseless folks around too, right?
Yeah. Well, and I think, like, more importantly, like, they were able to, like, access these resources in a way that, established, like, their own agency. Like, they weren't, like, it's not like they were like coming to like a drop-in center or like a shelter to be serviced. Like they were like servicing like themselves and each other, like just like everybody else in the camp.
Yeah. You know, it definitely was more than once that people would come up and be like, you know, timid about it and be like, oh, well, what's the situation? Or like, what's the protocol here? And like in terms of eating or something like that, you know, and then like whoever they were talking to would just be like, oh, well, you just go get food, you know?
That's awesome.
Yeah. And so I think that was really great.
And I think that's something that important that I also want to kind of like add an addendum to my earlier comments about like, you know, the houseless folks is they were an integral part of the camp. You know, it's not like that they was like, you know, there was a couple of instances, but it's not like, I mean, sometimes they, I mean, so, a lot of times, like, they were the people with the walkie-talkies that were helping stay up all night, you know, like on doing
that. And there were incidents with not houseless people as well who were douchebags. So, you know, it wasn't, it was across the board.
Yeah.
Of course.
Yeah.
Most assholes live in houses. All right, well... So I get, you know, we're at like an hour and a half. That's usually a good point to end it. If I don't know if y'all have any projects that you work on that you want to shout out, if people want to track any of your work, if you want, if you don't want to say anything, that's fine too. But if there's a way to follow any of your work, you can shout it out or not, whatever.
Like, you know, there's definitely like an Oli Stand Facebook page. There's an Oli Stand Twitter. And I think it's actually like Olympia Stand. Sorry, we always like shorten it to Oli here, but it's like Olympia Stand. And Mosquito. Yeah, Mosquito Fleet is another organization that like kept showing up. And like they're like also like, yeah, one of the big groups around here that like is really watching like, you know, a lot of this like, you know, oil and gas infrastructure.
Several of us are involved with the IWW as well.
Nice. Yeah, we showed up last year and this year. Good. I can't think of any others.
Yeah, that's
the Tide Foundation.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Yeah. So weird.
Shout out Acorn. Shout out George Soros, obviously. Oh, Daddy
Papa Soros.
Papa Soros. Yeah.
Nancy Pelosi. Hillary Clinton pantsuit.
You know.
Yeah, Red Bull. Yeah, we had Red Bull sponsorship for a minute. Like on the last day, there was like this giant like Red Bull poster that who the hell knows where it came from, but it was erected into a giant tent. So we had sponsorship for a day.
That's amazing.
Thanks to Red Bull. Those checks are also still trying to get cleared. Really, I don't know what's
going on. No, it was definitely the landscaping subcommittee of the Oli Stand build team that made that made that Red Bull happen.
Yeah, so big
These
shout
tents
out.
Were insane.
Totally.
I'm glad
so,
we got to subcommittee.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I don't know. Thank you for thanks for taking the time and for taking some risks for the good of humanity.
I got one last shout out. YouTube personality and all around gym, Colleen Wozner, who's not quite a legend, but a local curiosity. I don't know. But she visited the camp, and her follow-up video where she her follow-up video is a video of a video on her computer of the same video where she talks about like George Soros funding the camp.
Oh my goodness.
Oh, here's looking at you, Colleen.
I just found her. I found her. Colleen Wozner.
Well, yeah. Also, by the way, like if people want to like look at like some fun stuff from the camp, Cairo 7, which is also the news agency from Seattle, came down and like and got some like and did some actually not saying like look at all these dirty hippies like type of coverage, which was surprising. But anyway, you can see one of our raging black bloc dance parties that happened to catch a little bit of a videotape of people bouncing around like masked up, black flag, whole nine yards. But it's very funny because when the camp got evicted, like they did not get out of their SUV. Like they did their whole coverage. They're like, this is the police outside, there's the MRAP, it's like crazy. And you know, we had all basically just like left camp and we're like, yeah, cops suck. And so, yeah, you know, Cairo's funny. But anyway, yeah, dance parties. It was great.
And also, thank you for doing this.
Yeah, thanks.